have any questions before we talk about purification? Any questions? Yep. Yes. Microphone to Pierre, please.
Hey.
I was just
thinking, could you please give like some example of like you did with killing of,
what's
for instance, you know, you gave an example of how killing can ripen and stuff.
Yes.
I was thinking,
yes,
could you give an example on a positive thing like love, for instance, or generosity, or
yeah, how generosity. Yes. Do you ever in your life had people be kind to you?
Yeah, definitely.
Generous,
yeah,
to you?
Of course.
Loving. Well, there you go.
Yeah.
That's the result. There you go. Proof of the pudding. They're the result. If anybody who hears your words, and even if you're lying, they believe you, that's because you've got the karma of telling the truth. If people don't believe your words, even if you're telling the truth, that's the karma of lying. So each experience, if you think of your experiences, you know, in a day, and if you tracked your day, most of us could track our day in terms of pleasant or unpleasant experiences, wouldn't you agree? Some very unpleasant, some mildly unpleasant. You could do a little, like a little graph, you know? Instead of the external tracking, how'd you go today, Rabina? Well, you know, pleasant food and nice breakfast and the lights were red and the person was mean. We'd go pleasant, 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 pleasant. Very, very, very pleasant, unpleasant, unpleasant, unpleasant. Very, very suffering, very suffering. Pleasant, pleasant, mild, mild. You could track it internally. So each of those moments is the fruit. Each of those milliseconds of moments is a fruit of an action like that. It's, in a sense, not illogical. So whatever the character of your experience, people loving you, people not loving you, people thinking you're handsome, people thinking you're ugly, people lie, you know, every millisecond of our constant experiences with others, the fruit of your past action. That rat in your house is your rat baby. Welcome home, rat, eating what it thinks is his house. That's karma. Sentient beings. Do you understand?
Sure, definitely.
Okay,
yeah.
Good.
Thank you.
Okay. Yes. Please give the mic. Just say, okay, what's your name? Hamida. Hamida wants to tell us something. Ask something. Go, darling.
I was thinking about what you said about karma and intention.
Yes.
So I got a little bit confused about what it is I'm partaking in. So I work with women who are survivors of sexual violence.
You do what?
I work with women who are survivors.
Work with women who, okay.
Survivors of
yes,
sexual violence.
Exactly.
And I teach them self-defense.
I understand.
So I come from an Eskrima martial arts background.
Okay.
So what do you make of
that? I think it's brilliant. You know, I think it's really interesting. This whole way we talk about victims, women especially. So even though we're all trying to be equal and, you know, have equal pay and be seen equally, still it's easy for men and women both to fall into the trap of victimizing women. Wouldn't you agree? And the victim, this is the trouble, we start to take responsibility. The victim mentality is actually mixed with masses of anger because we feel so fearful, you know. So then you rage and go against the person who does it. So my feeling is far more powerful to go and learn martial arts and empower yourself than go off and sue somebody. Okay, maybe sue them too, but much better to punch them right back. That's not kidding. I'm not kidding now, because the victim one, especially with the male-female one and the rape business and the sexual abuse, it's so easy to fall into the trap of being a victim. But, you know, there's. I mean, even to the absurdity, I remember reading in the paper one time in Australia, I think it was. This is beyond ridiculous. I'm talking about the victim mentality, how we become paralyzed and want to blame and get angry and then no awareness and no empowerment, whereas what you're doing is empowering people. Fantastic. Not to be angry, but to be strong, right? But this particular example, this woman on an aeroplane had a panic attack, and the very kind steward calmed her down and let her lie on the back seats, you know? And then he came up later, she was half asleep, and he came up and he started touching her, feeling her up on the legs. She turned her iPhone on, whispering into it, "He's touching my legs. Now he's touching my upper body." Well, excuse me, I would suggest she stand up and say, "Go fuck off, please. Who do you think you are?" I mean, that to me is the absolute bizarre level of victim mentality. Do you see my point here, people? I mean, excuse me, what's saying? It doesn't mean you have to be mean to the person, but it's being empowered to stand up and say, "You can't even back off and leave me alone." I mean, I remember a lady, a friend of mine was in a bath, actually being naked, she was in a bath, you know, with water in it. And she heard someone coming in the back door, she thought it was her roommate, so she popped out of the bath, and it was this strange fellow coming to steal. Well, she screamed like a banshee and started chasing him. Well, what do you think he did? He didn't go and do anything, he ran like he couldn't get out quite quick enough. So we've got to learn to know we can become empowered. Doesn't mean you have to be aggressive, because when you're feeling confident, you're not aggressive. You're in charge of your life. Okay, some maniacs, you can't stop them. But if we feel empowered, so what you're doing is brilliant. Go for it. Definitely. Yes.
Just to link, for example, if we want to link morality and ethics with what we were discussing before in terms of the search for the right teacher and the right path, how could we, what should we think, for example, of the teachings and the validity of the teachings, or, for example, a very prominent teacher of Buddhism in the West who led a completely unethical life and died an alcoholic, for example, even though his teachings were brilliant.
This is where it gets really tricky. Because when we start to listen to the Bodhisattva teachings, and we're talking junior school here, which is the wisdom wing, the Bodhisattva teachings is another whole dimension that really needs to be based on understanding these first level of teachings. The Bodhisattva teachings basically, and there's different sets of vows. The first level are the vows we're discussing here, mainly about behavior, controlling, back off, don't harm others. Perfect. It's the basis of practice and can get us phenomenal results internally. Then you've got a next level of practice, which is according to the Bodhisattva path. And that is the assumption being that you're a highly realized being, you've given up attachment, you've realized emptiness, and now you keep being reborn in this life solely to benefit others. So you're a highly realized being, but you've got this another set of vows, another level of vows that actually are more about how to benefit others. And there's even a vow there where you would break an earlier vow if it were truly for the sake of others. Now that's a big, intense thing to say. So theoretically, it's completely possible for a highly realized being beyond ego, beyond attachment, to come into this life and manifest in a certain way that looks like immoral in order to help sentient beings. But this is too much for our poor minds. We don't like hearing this. We just want to think they're bad. So we don't know. So Tibetans have a nice saying: you don't know who anybody is, so don't judge. And this gets really tricky. Because then if I think, well, if I don't judge, maybe that rapist is a bodhisattva, so I better let them do their job. No, act according to the laws of the world. If you see a rapist, if you can stop them, kindly stop them. It might be a bodhisattva, but it's a bit of a shock to us to hear this. But we've got to understand these teachings really well. So then how do we judge? We can't. We don't know who is anybody. So maybe your best way is to say, play safe and choose a nice teacher like the Dalai Lama who behaves well. I mean, you know. But this is what's interesting. The sixth Dalai Lama, the story goes, this one's the 14th. The sixth Dalai Lama, there was all this politics at the time of the fifth, and they were building that big potala, you know. And so because every time a new Dalai Lama comes along, it's like a new regime comes along, you know. And the fifth people regime were really worried that if they recognized the new one, that the new regime would come and they wouldn't be able to finish the potala. So they pretended the fifth, who had died, was in retreat. So they didn't recognize him for quite a few years until he was about 12, but they kind of lost him by then. That is sort of, he got reborn and he wasn't recognized formally, so wasn't educated in the proper way. So by the time I got him, he didn't want to be a boring old monk. But it's still said that he is the reincarnation, a completely enlightened Buddha. That's what they say, right? So Tibetans have so much confidence and faith in the Buddha and in the Buddha's teachings and the Dalai Lama that this little one, the sixth Dalai Lama, is renowned for hanging out with the prostitutes and writing love poetry. Well, they all still adored him and had complete faith that it was the Buddha, that the Dalai Lama, they had no problem. But, you know, imagine if the Dalai Lama, who's 18 now, starts disrobing and hanging out with the girls. I would say 99.9% of people who thought he was wonderful will now think he's horrible. Because we've got very deluded in our world and we need nice, moral, well-behaved examples. So there can be high beings who do behave badly, but you don't know that. So play safe and don't choose them. My point. But if you have got a being, you know, if you do have faith and you do see their holy qualities, I mean, you know, there's this nun, one of his main disciples, you know. His nun, she has American nun, teaches a lot. What's her name? Tenzin. Who?
Pema Chodron,
okay. She's a wonderful nun, completely good experience. And her lama is this one. So she has pure view, you know. So it's interesting to look at this. But I think if we're just looking into choosing, you know, play safe. Pick a nice person who behaves well. It helps. Do you understand?
Yeah.
But if you only get clairvoyance, you'll be able to see things differently. Do you understand? Okay. Someone else? Yes, darling.
When you get reincarnated and you decided you were going to pop in and interrupt your mummy and daddy's lovemaking.
Well, you wouldn't interrupt, you just kind of enter there. They'll continue on.
Yeah, you just sort of, well, they didn't notice, but you popped in there.
Yeah,
you zapped in.
Yep. But you won't decide, darling, until you're a very highly realised being.
Yeah.
The karma drives you there.
I was going to say, are there, do we have some sense of who we're, I mean, is there a connection? Is there a reason why we're born into
certain
families?
Oh, gosh, yes, highly developed reason. There's a very strong karmic connection between that family and you.
Okay.
There's no question. That's why we get the mummy we deserve and the daddy.
Right.
But you don't, until you're a highly realised being, they would say in Buddhism, you don't actually, oh, there's the womb I want to go to.
Yeah.
No, you just kind of, your past karma drives you to it. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But the very logical reason why, it wouldn't be a random event. There's got to be strong history between you and those parents. Or, indeed, if you get born a dog, between you and that dog.
Okay.
Yeah, definitely.
Just wondering why I'm surrounded by lunatics in my family.
Well, darling, it's... there you go. It's a teaching for you, babe. When you're born, you must have had strong compassion, and you're born to this family to help them. How kind of you. Yes.
Just to clarify one point. You're saying that it's coming the way you're born. But it seems that realized being, they can choose where they want to be born.
Absolutely. Totally, yes.
That's correct.
Yeah, at a certain level, you've got complete control over the process. Yes, definitely.
Okay.
That's what they say. Definitely. Yes.
Can I ask about white lies?
White lies? What's a white lie? What's a white lie? Just be clear.
I'm working with people, with vulnerable people, on streets, with homeless people, and often to put them to accommodation, I have to tell a little
lie. You do what? Sorry, I missed you. What?
With homeless.
Who?
Homeless.
Hummus? Homeless. Okay. Go on. Go on, yes.
So, and rules in London are quite strict, so outreach has to find someone, but they're down on the street in order to take him to a hostel.
Go on, then.
So I often know that people, it's very difficult sometimes to find them, so sometimes I know that they're homeless because I've met them, let's say, day centre, and I will lie.
To whom?
To hostel.
What will you say?
That, yes, he is rough sleeping. I saw him in the morning sleeping rough in order to take him to the hostel so he can be...
Where was he? How was that a lie? I missed the point. How was that a lie?
Yeah, because I didn't see him literally being on the street.
Where did you see him then?
In the day centre where he goes, for example, for breakfast.
So you know he lives on the street?
Yeah, I know he lives on the street.
So
he's smelly.
Well, all you got to do is tell him, walk outside, sit on the street, and then you're not lying. I mean, I'm not kidding. I'm sort of kidding, but not.
No, if I would meet him, yes, that would be the case. But often we don't meet those people because they just often move, you know? It's
but
just
you
just
like
said sick
he's,
and
he was in
game.
The tea. You were just having a... Where was he when you saw him?
In one of the centres when they go for food, like food.
Okay,
food
so bank. He was living on the street then?
I know
he
that
normally
he
lives
is.
On the street?
Yes.
So why don't you just go tell him, walk outside, come outside, please sit on the street, sit down the street, and you say you met him on the street. You didn't lie. Very simple.
Well, not really, because rules are very strict. I have to see him in our borough. I work in SADC for SADC Council.
Okay.
And
So you are lying. It is a lie. But if you can, you know, from the Bodhisattva's perspective, you do it with the purest of motivation. But why would you have to go to him? Why can't you find the ones on the street, which is the rule? There's plenty on the streets.
I know, but I mean, if somebody, let's say he's saying that he's sleeping, but I still didn't see him, and Rusa, I have to find him first to take him to accommodation.
But I know that.
So then
I know that, but I'm wondering why you choose this one and not the one on the street. There's plenty on the street. I'm just a bit confused.
It's
during the day.
Hey?
During the day, they're in
place. Yeah, but
like, can I think, I mean, can you just help people, please?
Yeah.
Don't worry too much.
No, the rules are very strict.
Okay, then be strict with the rules and help people as best you can.
Yeah, but then I have to lie sometimes.
Okay, then lie. Go ahead and lie then. Oh!
Which I do. And now
can
my
you
question
put the
is...
microphone down, please? Enough is enough. Yes. Give the man the microphone. Well, the woman. No, she said, can you purify? Yes, that's not the point here. It's like this seems... No, leave it. Don't, stay right there. Do not go it. No, leave it. Leave it right there. No, nothing to say. Don't worry too much, please. I mean, do your best to help people. And if you have to wiggle a little line here and there, I mean, but don't start being too ridiculous about it. Try and stick to the rules best you can. But, you know, help people, please. Next question. Okay, so now let's look at how we purify...
Can I ask something?
yes.
Very, very good link.
Yeah, go on.
I'm just curious about this. If I see an animal who's half dead and want to kill it so that it stops suffering.
Well, we discussed this before.
I know, but I don't remember. Could you just tell me quickly?
Excuse me, don't blame me because you didn't remember.
I don't, I'm not blaming
you. Why
don't
you take notes? If this were a cooking class, you'd be in trouble if you didn't write down the recipe.
I know.
Well, why don't you take notes?
I don't know.
Well, you're dumping it on me because you have got a bad memory.
But would it be bad karma?
Ask your friend. Excuse me. You're going to have to get me to say the whole thing all again because you can't be bothered writing notes. Sweetie pie, he remembers it.
It wouldn't be
that. Is he your friend?
Commas,
just a minute. Is he your friend?
Yes.
Well, then he will tell you later, and then you can ask again tomorrow if he got it wrong. Okay. Please think about it, darling. Otherwise, just being lazy. Are we communicating? My job is to talk. Your job is to write the notes and remember it. Okay. Do you mind? But it is a good question. I'll tell you what. No, make it as an exercise. Try and remember what we talked about. Think it through logically. Look up your wretched notes that I put all this time into doing on the 10 non-virtues. Try and look at it and see if you can come up with the answer yourself. Would you do that for me? Homework. And you tell me tomorrow morning your answer. Will you do that? Will you be here? Well, then tell him your answer. Okay. All right. Okay. So let's talk about... Yes? Path gradual is the technical translation, but I would suggest the better translation is a course. A course. It's a course. Well, you grade one, grade two, then you graduate at the end. It's a course, basically. Do you understand? It's all the Buddha's teachings on metaphysics and psychology and philosophy, all presented in a nice, orderly way, like any body of knowledge, in terms of the capacity of the person to internalize it. Do you see? So they call it lowest scope of capacity, middle scope. Well, I prefer to call it junior school, high school, university, and then the Vajrayana is the postgraduate. It really is like that exactly. What is sutra? It's sutra is the type of teaching of the Buddha, the general teachings that aren't the teachings on Vajrayana. Tantra is all the teachings and the more esoteric teachings in the Mahayana path, which is like postgraduate. So the first teachings, you know, there's different analogies I use, the wisdom wing and the compassion wing, right? The wisdom wing is junior school and high school of the Lam Rim. It's all the teachings shared by the Theravadin path. All the teachings on karma, controlling your body and speech, living in vows, and then you go to the second level, which is high school, where you start to concentrate, meditate, learn about the mind, remove all the delusions, and then if you finish there, if you're going to graduate at high school, you'd realize emptiness, perfect all that, and then you'd leave samsara. Bye-bye, I'm gone. Finished. Cooked. But if you want to, you can add to the next component, which is the compassion wing, which is the university level, I'm putting it this way, where you've got your realizations, but you want to help others. So you keep coming back to continue to develop, to become a Buddha. And then you continue to benefit other sentient beings. And then you can go to further on to hasten your progress into the teachings called the Vajrayana, which is part of the Mahayana teachings. Yes. Huh? What about it? What do you mean? Oh, they're all technical. What do you mean? What are you saying that for? What do you mean technical? What is? No, darling, it's not like that. The words are not wrong, but it's not the meaning. Okay. You've got Buddhism. You can divide it into different ways, the teachings of the Buddha. You can divide, the main way you can divide in terms of the countries where Buddhism exists, you've got what's called the Theravadin teachings, and then you've got the Mahayana teachings. Do you understand? Have you heard those words? Okay, so countries like Burma, Thailand, are the Theravadin teachings, the goal of which is to achieve your own liberation from suffering, the goal of which is to achieve your nirvana by doing the job we're talking about today. Do you understand? Right. So then you've got the next, and then you use this analogy, the Lam Rim is this packaging of all these teachings. The first two stages of it, which is like I calling junior school and high school, that's this component. If you graduated at high school, you finish the Theravadin level of the practice, you achieve your own nirvana, and you say bye-bye to samsara, you're finished. Do you understand? Now you have this next stage of practice, which is in this Lam Rim, this Tibetan packaging of Buddha's teachings, which incorporates the Mahayana component of the teachings, which is the teachings where you continue. Even if you've finished the path and you don't need to come back, you consciously want to come back because you've accomplished this state called bodhicitta, which is the aspiration to want to continue to benefit others, become a Buddha, go further. So you now add compassion to the mix, you get reborn, 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 life after life after life, and you accomplish Buddhahood, full enlightenment, they say. Okay? So that means you now continue to be reborn continuously for the sake of others, based on compassion and wisdom. So the other analogy I used, wisdom and compassion, the wisdom wing is the first two stages. You with me? And the compassion wing is this compassion component. So Vajrayana or Tantra is the practices in the Mahayana where you would continue to practice that'll hasten your progress. It's like I said, to be a speedy path. It's sort of like postgraduate. So junior school is control your body, speech and mind and at least abide by the laws of karma. The result of that is you'll get another decent human rebirth. If you continue to the next level, which is high school, you start to look at your mind, get rid of the delusions, realize emptiness, and you don't need to come back anymore. Then you continue on to the compassion wing if you want to come back to continue adding to the mix all this compassion teachings. So now you become a Buddha and then you hasten that by jumping into the Vajrayana or Tantra, which are these most advanced level, which will hasten the result of your Buddhahood. Then you can continue to come back for, you know, till time endless to benefit others. Do you get me, roughly? Darling, it's like anything. It's like it's a system. It takes time to learn the words, doesn't it? Like any system, it's all technical. It's just words that refer to things. We have to learn the language, isn't it? Like music or anything. That's all. Does it make sense? All right, darling. So let's look at how we purify karma. So how we create karma is already very interesting in this particular one, like I mentioned, the 10 non-virtues, this teaching in there, or the way we've been describing, like the mouse one. That's how you create karma. And virtuous karma is exactly the same. A complete karmic action of generosity, for example, would have to be first the object, you know, Natasha. Then there has to be the second, 2A. That's, I have to recognize it's Natasha I'll give my £20 to. 2B is the intention. I will give £20 to Natasha. 2C is my reason. The best is a pure motivation, kindness, compassion, love. That pure motivation, that's what makes it virtuous when I do it. The third is I do the action, and the fourth is the result. She gets the 20 quid. That's a complete action of virtue. This is how we create karma, simply speaking. It's far more subtle and more nuanced than that because there's so many things involved. But essentially, they're the bare bones components of an action, if it were a complete action. Are we communicating here? So we can see many of our actions in daily life aren't complete. You might have the thought to give you £20 to Vanessa, but to Natasha, she runs off and doesn't, you know, you didn't get her in time. So you had the thought, but you didn't do the action. Sometimes you drop your £20 and she picks it up. You didn't create any virtue at all. So there's variations of these continuously. But a complete action has all these components. The object, the recognition, the intention, the motivation, the action, the result. And it's very nuanced and subtle exactly what the karma is every time because it's so each individual is so different. Yes. Can we have the microphone, please?
Hi. even if you are doing a positive, creating a positive karma, which is complete, isn't still a, you're doing it from a self-existing nature, so you're still seeing conventional reality, so isn't that contaminated?
Of course it is. Of course it's contaminated. We're not talking of actions done in out of emptiness yet. We're talking about conventional actions of morality based on a reasonable motivation. We're still in samsara here. We're talking about at least stopping negative karma to try and do positive karma. But then as you're more advanced and you realize emptiness, then it's not going to be contaminated. It'll be powerful, much more powerful, of course. Of course.
So my desire to become enlightened, or when I dedicate the practice for the benefit of all sentient beings, this enlightenment is still a conceptual idea in my head. So,
well, of course it is.
Is this attachment? Is this desire that
I have? Of course it is, until you realize emptiness. Of course it's going to be attachment, darling. It's impossible, utterly, completely impossible to do anything without attachment and some level of delusion until we have realized emptiness. Of course it is, but we've got to start somewhere. We've got to do what we can, you know. So as we progress and get less and less attachment and more power and more bodhicitta and more wisdom, our virtues become more and more powerful. We've got to start somewhere, you know. Do you see? It's progressive, naturally. Right now, most of the virtue we do is completely polluted by our attachment and our delusions. Of course it is. But better than only doing delusion. One step ahead, you know. Do you see? Of course. It makes sense completely. So when we accept that, we won't start getting all guilty, you know. We can only do what we can do, isn't it?
Thank you.
Okay. So how do we clean up karma? How do we purify karma? And what's the function of it, you know? So right back to this first thought, that there is no karma, there is no intentional action that sows a seed in the mind that can't be changed. Well, it depends on time. If in 1 minute, you know, your seed that is about to sprout, it's a bit late to pull it out. You know, but still, even before the minute, if you can pull it out, great, isn't it? So with our actions, the karmic, there's a constant dynamic process unceasingly going on in our mind, playing out in our mind. It doesn't play out anywhere else. There's nowhere else. There's only mind or there's matter. Karma, you know, affects matter in the way I described before, but karma plays out in the mind. There's nowhere else for it to play out. It's the name given to the natural law that's created by mind, supported by body and speech, that expresses itself in our lives. So all these imprints, if mind is not physical, it's really hard to use words. You only use words that kind of give a sense of it. To say a seed in the mind is completely intellectual because there's no seed anywhere because a seed is a physical thing, but we use this in a very abstract way, you know. The best, this analogy of seeds and fruits is a really good one. And it's, but it's very hard, again, to conceptualize it because we can't even imagine something that isn't physical, which of course is consciousness, you know. The only time we talk about something physical, non-physical, in a spiritual teaching is when it's called a soul. So this is kind of Buddha talking about non-physical, but he doesn't call it a soul, he calls it consciousness, mind. So basically, okay, we, as Lama Yeshe says, we create, can't we create negativity with our mind. So we purify it by creating positivity with our mind. And again, this is not cosmic. If you're learning musical theory and you're playing Bach on the piano, and you have a tendency to play to read that note wrongly, well, you'll keep reading the note wrongly, you keep playing the wrong note. But then you notice that you played the wrong note, you will stop, you will look at the note, you'll tell yourself you played a wrong note, you will decide, I must play the right note. Well, if you keep playing the right note, guess what happens to you playing the wrong note? It disappears, isn't it? It's just natural. Your tendency to play the wrong note diminishes every time you play the right note. So it's a natural process of purification, if you like. Whereas we have this very powerful, okay, due to ego grasping, this root delusion, because we so primordially identify with the status quo, depressed me, angry me, hopeless me, jealous me, useless me, permanent me, this is very powerful in our being. One of the delusions, in fact, I mean, okay, the delusions, the root delusion, as I said, the one that runs the show totally, that informs attachment in the first place, which effectively, attachment, runs the show in day-to-day life, which causes anger when it doesn't get what it wants, etc., etc. But it's all informed by this root delusion, this primordial misconception, but instinctive, primordial misconception of an inherent, real, permanent, pointable, solid self that we believe totally runs the show, you know? So this misconception in the mind, like I said, is primordial. We don't even give words to it in our culture. We just take it as a given. Now, another delusion that's massive, I used the word earlier, but I shouldn't have there, this other delusion that's grosser delusion to this one, but it's as a consequence of this one, we believe the I is permanent. This I is permanent. So then we believe things are permanent. So when you found happiness, we say, finally I have found happiness. We assume it'll last forever. When you're depressed and can't see the light at the end of the tunnel, you assume it'll last forever. This is one of the major delusions in our mind, the grasping at things as permanent. It's not the grossest delusion, but it's pretty intense. So all these delusions playing their role to freeze us in space, to cause us to believe I'm hopeless, I'm no good. I mean, talking to people, you know, especially people in prison, where they've killed, for example. So the usual view of, you know, when you do something naughty, you need to be forgiven. But no one's going to forgive you. You've just killed them. And you can't hold your breath and hope the parents will forgive you. No one's going to forgive you. So there's this terrible sense of incredible depression, I see, among people in prison who've killed, because they feel it's completely permanent. There's nothing they can do, because if we assume that purification comes from forgiveness, which is the Christian teaching, nothing wrong with it, but it's not the Buddha's view. And so therefore we feel if no one's going to forgive me and the world thinks you're a creep, especially if you're on death row. One of my friends on death row, Mitch, who's a Buddhist, I've known him for, you know, nearly 20 years. A very wonderful human being, has transformed his life. He's on death row. I'm ready for that electric jolt, he said. He's finally been turned down for all his appeals after 30 years in prison. He's going to get executed very soon, you know. So he said it was just, you know, he's a wonderful human being who's really transformed himself. He's so special on that yard where all the 40 guys on death row live. They all live together in their red jumpsuits. He's just kind, loving. He looks after his old grandma and grandpa and his parents and his children, his grandchildren. He's like 50-something now. And he's ready, you know, he's ready for death. He's just a very wonderful human being. But he said it was very scary and rather depressing to suddenly read in the local paper about this monster, you know, and his friend Leif, who's a Catholic, both on the same place, these two monsters who killed three people when they had, you know, the shootout 30 years ago when they were dealing drugs. I mean, if you deal drugs and there are guns, people are going to die. They're not psychos, you know. It's a tragedy of guns. So he said it was really kind of rather scary to read this image of himself in this paper, these two monsters who murdered these three people, and all the people who are furious and the family furious and the prosecutors and the police and everybody hating you. It's quite intense, you know, quite intense. So if you had the view that you had to be forgiven before you got better, give up, I'm sorry, you're not going to get forgiven. So then to really feel that God will forgive you, you've got to become a Christian for that. And that's really hard, you know, for people to really feel they've been forgiven when the whole world doesn't forgive you. So the Buddha's view has got nothing to do with forgiveness, and this is where it's tough. So let's look at the Buddhist process, okay, of changing your karma. So there's a really nice way of describing, and all this is in your book here, of the process of what they call purification. It just means changing, you know, weakening the karmic imprints. But there are four steps. And again, like all of this stuff of Buddhism, it's all psychological. You could say if it's not about your mind, it doesn't exist in Buddhism. There's a shock again because we think spiritual is, you know, weird and wonderful. If it's not about your mind, it's not Buddhism. It's just superstition. So this is a psychological process. And it's got four steps, basically. And there's a nice way to remember them. I always like this four ways to remember, the four R's. So there's a different order. You see it in different practices. And this way I like this particular one. It's using the analogy of having, the lamas use this, having eaten poison. So, okay, the first step is called regret. It's a common English word, but it's defined it here in the way it means here. It's very specific. So I always quote this. His Holiness was asked one time, what's the difference between regret and guilt? And it was such a sweet but profound answer. He said, guilt, and we all know guilt, we're really good at it. Guilt, you look in the past and you say, I did this and I did that and I did this. And then you say, and I'm a bad person. Is this not guilt? Do we not know this well? And it seems to us totally logical. This is exactly what we assume. But if we look into the Buddhist explanation of it, that's the function of ego grasping. That attachment, you know, attachment didn't get what it wanted. So then we have aversion, which is anger. And guess who you turn it against? Yourself. Listen to anger. You did this, and you did that, and you did this, and you're a bad person. So it's exactly the same as anger. The difference is you're the object. And I'm not kidding here. Psychologically, it's aversion, which is anger. Blame. You're the blame. Or he's the blame. No difference. So that's guilt. And that, for us, is logical. That's the way ego works. I did this, therefore I'm a bad person. I did this, therefore I'm a good person. You did that. Either way, both extremes. So there's some truth in it, but ego exaggerates. It exaggerates. The way to put it in Buddhist view is, excuse me, you did kill, lie, steal, bad mouth, kick the dog. They are what's bad, not the whole of you. It's a complete exaggeration. And that's exactly, you know, what the delusions do. I haven't gone to this much, but we'll do a bit now. Delusions in their nature, the key function of them is that they exaggerate, they embellish. So attachment, for example, it's got the fundamental energy, like I said, you're born with it, huge dissatisfaction, primordial feeling of never being enough, never having enough. It drives us every millisecond. The second, like I said, it doesn't get what it wants, panic attack, and it turns into aversion. So the stronger attachment, the stronger it doesn't get what it wants, the stronger the aversion or the anger or the depression or the guilt. Same. So they just naturally exaggerate. So, you know, the more, so then attachment, like I said, dissatisfaction, which then causes, craving, you know, hankering after something. It then causes, to the first level, which is the objects of the senses, there are much subtler levels of attachment, which we'll talk about tomorrow. But this one, you know, the chocolate cake, let's say. You feel dissatisfied. What do I want? Oh, cake. Oh, good. You're all excited. So then you get up, you go to the fridge, you open it up, then you're coming out. So then what attachment does, you go get you hanker after it, then you go get it. The hands and the feet do the job. They get the chocolate cake. And then what happens, and this is the biggest lie, which is the hardest one to see, is the attachment in the mind is so excited. It's got an excitement energy. It makes the cake look dazzling. It makes the cake look delicious. It makes the cake look so delicious. And it's like this, isn't it? It's out there on the plate, like looking dazzling and divine, kind of begging me to eat it. Is it not? Can you see what I'm saying? And like, it's almost as if, you know, and this is exactly what's happening. So much neediness, so much dissatisfaction, so much craving, so much exaggeration. So then you've got no choice but to shove it in, you know? And this hole, not this one. We know the hole it goes in. Because we're trained from countless lives, you know. But the worst one is that the attachment in the mind makes the cake look delicious. This is the killer. And of course, we don't think our attachment makes the cake look delicious. This is the point. We think the cake out there on that plate is in itself delicious, as if you put a spoonful of deliciousness in the recipe. Meaning, and this is exactly how ego works, it's like, it's got nothing to do with me. Hey, there's that cake, so divine, so delicious, just begging me to eat it. Poor me, I can't, it was not my fault. Is it not? Then you shove it in, you know. And then, of course, the anticipation of the satisfaction, so frantic, even though you've got the first mouthful in, already your hand's going out for the next one. I remember reading about a boy who was attached to sex with girls. Went to one of those sex programs, you know, the AA, SA, I suppose, Sex Anonymous or something, whatever they call. I'm not being rude. It's all right. We're all junkies. He talked about how as he's on one girl, he can't wait to get on the next girl. That's how attachment works. It never stops thinking, analyzing, imagining, fantasizing. It's like this gone berserk. Always anticipating, always looking forward, always wanting something more, always exaggerating. It's a nightmare. This is what runs our lives, Buddha says. Why am I talking about attachment here? I forgot. I was talking about purification. Where are we going? Oh, yes, oh, regret. Guilt. Okay, whatever. Okay, yeah, attachment. Okay, guilt. Guilt is anger. So when anger is the response when attachment doesn't get what it wants. In every case, here the attachment is just this primordial neediness to be feel good, get good. So as soon as you go kill somebody, then the whole world hates you. And okay, now I have to talk about the deeper level of attachment here. The deeper level of attachment is so depressing. Forget the gross one. This is junior school, already profound. But the deeper level, so primordial, is this frantic attachment, constant craving to be seen as a nice person. This is the worst, the most painful, and the hardest to see. This really does run the show. They say that the yogis, the meditators, have given up everything. They've given up sex, drugs, and rock and roll, the works. They're in the mountains meditating, but they're still thinking of what the people in the village are thinking about them. That's this attachment. This runs most of our decisions. Every millisecond, we are frantic to be seen as a good girl. And therefore, we are desperate to have our bad things hidden. This is primordial within us, and this is attachment, the worst level, the deepest level, the hardest one to see. So there I'm talking about Mitch in prison. That's what I was getting at, I think. He's put himself together. I admire him. But when you read about this monster in the paper, you can't see that, you know. He said it was quite humbling to read this. He knows he's not that person. But that's the view, the world. He's a monster. He's a murderer. He's on death row. He's evil. He should be burned in hell. So forget forgiveness, you know. So if we rely upon that, kill yourself now. You won't get it. So the Buddhist view of purification is you've got to do the work yourself. So, okay, if guilt is that one, which is despairing because I'm bad, until someone gets me off the hook by forgiving me, please, I'm not being rude here. We're desperate to be let off the hook. But instead of this, you've got regret, and this is the Buddhist view. And this is junior school, but profound. So you look in the past, as His Holiness said, and you go, I did do that, I did do this, I did do that. But then you go, what can I do about it? Not stuck in stone, not seen as permanent, not despairing, not hopeless, not exaggerating your ugliness. No, more precise, more intelligent, more adult. And so the other crucial component of regret is this. Let's use the one of taking poison. It's really obvious to us. Let's say you announced to me that, Robina, you ate the wrong lunch and you ate the one with poison in it. Well, believe me, this is our usual mode of responding when we do naughty things, because it is a ridiculous view of morality. You listen, you know. So one response would be, oh, I ate poison. I'm such a bad person. And I'm getting sicker and sicker every day, and I keep saying, I'm such a bad person. It's completely useless, right? Completely, insanely, absurdly useless. The first thing anybody with half a brain would do if they've taken poison, you know, once they've calmed down, is quick, for God's sake, where's the doctor? Where's the antidote? What can I do about it? We would all do this naturally, but we're not used to thinking that negativity done by me will bring responses to me, will bring suffering to me, just like poison, so I better get the hell about doing something. It's really powerful, but we're not used to thinking this way. We're just used to the guilt, the self-loathing, the hopelessness, the paralysis, you know. So the first step, this is why this practice, we do it at the end of every day. As Lama Zopa says very simply, we are insane not to do it every day. So it's a bit like gardening, because we know that seeds and things are highly dynamic. You leave them even for 24 hours and the garden goes berserk. We know this. It's vivid to us. So we know being a good gardener, you're on the case every day. Every day, karma's like that, dynamic, every millisecond we're creating karma. And because we're deluded, we're going to be creating lots of negative karma. It's just the way it is. Don't have a panic attack. But you'd be on the case if you knew that. You'd be in charge of it. You'd be responsible. You'd be watching your mind like a hawk. You'd be living in your vows. You'd be protecting yourself because you don't want suffering. This is the reason to regret. The reason to regret eating poison is nothing fancy. It's because you don't want a bellyache. You don't want to die. You don't want suffering. No one has to prove that to you. And no one says, oh, how selfish you are, Robina. Of course you don't want suffering. So this very first level of practice is massive. And it's all about what they call renunciation. Renunciation is this, it's got two parts. It's this powerful state of mind of self-respect. That you realize, even intellectually, but you're taking it on board, that whatever you think and do and say has in the past has in the past programmed your mind and will ripen as your suffering, and that whatever you do say now and think and do will ripen as future suffering. And it's based upon the simple recognition, you know what, I am sick to death of suffering. I'm up to here with suffering. This feeling that I'm sick of suffering. You've got to know what suffering is, and we've only discussed the first one, really. There's two more levels. So this attitude of renunciation, which sounds kind of forbidding, it's a very mature state of mind. It's a grown-up state of mind. It's a person who's really in charge of their own life, who feels that they're the producer of themselves and they can transform themselves. So it's a genuine sense of self-respect. It's got zero to do with guilt, zero, blame, none of this. It's profound. So if you had renunciation, you know, it sounds forbidding, but it means you want to renounce two things, suffering and its causes. So that means you have to be aware of what suffering is and its causes. So suffering is the first level, having, you know, the punches come back, not to mention the subtler level, which is the psychological suffering of the delusions, which bring so much nightmare, which are the source. And then you have to, and these are the cause. So that means you want to recognize your suffering. You don't want the suffering. You're sick to death of suffering, and you now know why you're suffering, which is your ridiculous karma and your ridiculous delusions. Even recognizing this, that's renunciation. So it's like recognizing you don't want cancer, you know the cause is cigarettes, I'm sick to death of that, I don't want it further, I don't want my, you know, my lungs hurting, I'm going to therefore give up the cause, give up smoking. It's logical and reasonable. So here, abiding by the laws of karma, refraining from killing, lying, stealing, etc., is the method. But the purification at the end of every day adds to this. So you sit to the end of the day, you kind of, you know, check up your day, and you regret. You can go through the list if you like. You could get killing, lying, stealing, anything you remember today, this life. And you say the words, I regret this. You know why? You talk to yourself. You're talking to yourself. You're becoming your own friend. Why do I regret? Not the usual guilt, pathetic self-loathing. I regret that because, you know what, I don't want future suffering. This really takes us time because it means we have to articulate karma, think about it, read the teachings, and take it on board and make this connection between why I regret because I don't want the suffering, which is due to karma. So it takes a while to get into this, you know, because we're not used to thinking this way. We just have bad feelings and feel guilty and hope no one saw. Well, this is infantile, you know. It takes time to do this, really. It's a very amazing practice. This is just renunciation, first one. So then, after you've regretted, you're killing, you're lying, you're stealing, you're bad-mouthing, you've broken vows, whatever, you go through the list, happily, you want to go through it. Then you think, next step, what can I do about it? Well, you first think, whom can I turn to? Where's the doctor, please? And that's our relationship with the Buddha. He's not our creator. He's a mentor. He's a person who's advising us. He's like our music teacher, like a person who's amazing, who shows us by their very presence what you can become like. So, of course, you rely on that person, you know, this knowledge holder. And that's the Buddha, Mr. Buddha, 2,500 years ago. So, of course, in our case, in the Mahayana, all the Buddhist ones, but especially for us, there's a strong emphasis on the present person in your life. Who is the teacher? Who is the Buddha for you in this life? Buddha's not here any longer, you know. It's nice to read his teachings, but it's good to have a human being in front of you who embodies all of this. That's the teacher. Gives you courage, gives you optimism, shows you what you can become. So you rely upon the Buddha. That's refuge. You rely, you're delighted that you have a Buddha. There's this person. So this is like a doctor. So then there's two things here. There's two things that have to be in your mind before you go to a doctor. It's obvious the first one has to be that you're sick, or that you don't want to get sick. It's preventative or curative, isn't it? Clearly, you wouldn't go to a doctor because he's cute. Well, I mean, you might if you want a partner or something, but not wouldn't go to a doctor because they're cute or because you think you should or someone vaguely says you ought to. You've got a clear reason because you do not want this suffering, baby. Pretty obvious. But the second one, crucial, you've got to have some confidence that they're a decent doctor. And that part's up to us. That doctor's done their job. Maybe you've taken poison and there's a doctor you heard somewhere in Iceland or Tasmania. I don't know, which part of the world am I? So when I'm in this part of the world, I say Tasmania. When I'm in Australia, I say Iceland. So, you know, there's a doctor way down the bottom of the world in Tasmania who you've heard about has got all the antidotes to every poison. But let's say before you know you've taken poison, you might hear about this fancy doctor and you're very interested, but you don't care much because you don't need him. But let's look how you feel now you need this doctor. Where'd you say he was? Tasmania, I'm going. Do you understand my point? So you've got to know you need that doctor, but you've got to have confidence. You must have. You choose the person you're going to rely upon. So you've got to choose, if you're going to choose Mr. Buddha, don't just choose him because he's cute, a little lump on his head looking holy. Like Robert Thurman said, his brains, you've got so many brains they're poking out. I don't know what the Yushnisha means. I never learned, so I always say that one. Good enough. So, you know, you rely on the Buddha, but it means you've got to have, just liking Buddha because someone said you should be a Buddhist or be mindful is just not powerful enough, you know. You've got to know your suffering, and this is really taking us time. The trouble is we don't know about the subtle suffering, the inner prison. I didn't mention that, did I? Always example? I did. When Arturo, I didn't mention that. Maybe it was yesterday or the day before. It was yesterday when I was in Eastbourne, that's right. So, okay, I'll tell you now. The second kind of suffering, Buddha calls it the suffering of change, which is really what we call happiness, which is why it's hard to see. We haven't gone into it much. It's like a honey-covered razor blade. This is the suffering that the first suffering comes from anger. from having done anger in the past. This one comes from attachment. So it's very hard to see this one. Very hard to see the suffering of change. So, you know, but this is, I know one time when the friends I had in prison, we'd send them mandala and they'd see about Lama Zopa, so they'd write to him. And so he'd write these endless, long, wonderful letters of advice. But the commonest thing he'd say to them, you know, and the very first one who wrote was this young Mexican, I always quote Arturo. He's been there since he was in gangs since he's 11, in Mexican gangs in Los Angeles, in prison since he's 12. Tried as an adult when he was 16, three life sentences. And he's sort of, right now there's these new laws they're trying to open up the possibility for prisoners in California who were tried as adults but who were in fact juveniles. Being 16, you're called a juvenile. So they're giving them a chance to get out, you know, earlier than their sentence. So anyway, Arturo's in that process. But the point is, when he first wrote to Lama Zopa, he was in this type of prison called permanent lockdown, in these small cells, no bigger than your bathroom, not an American bathroom, an English bathroom with a bathtub in it, maybe a shower, you know? Little bathroom with a toilet and a shower, 8 foot by 10 foot or something, with two bunks. You're allowed to have 10 books, no hardback because you can whack your cellmate. The inside of a pen, because you use the hard part to stab your cellmate. You can only drink cordial, you can't drink hot drinks, you might tip it on your cellmate. And you're living in these 8 cells, these little pods, where the noise is inconceivable, like being in bedlam all day, they say. And people live in this 10, 20, 30 years until they die. No sunshine, no air, like hell. And they kill each other regularly. Well, you live in a room even for a few weeks with your beloved, you would kill each other. 23 hours a day, okay? So anyway, there you are. He's living in this cell, like that, in this situation. He's out of it. He's out of that now. And Lama Zopa said to him, and this is the point I'm getting to, he said, your prison is nothing in comparison with the inner prison of ordinary people. And we're that people. That's our group. And then he said, the prison of attachment, the prison of pride, the prison of depression, the prison of jealousy. So on the face of it, we hear that and we kind of feel a bit embarrassed, you know, because none of us would dare say that our suffering is anything like living in that kind of environment, living in a war zone, living in living being a slave to somebody, a terrible, grosser suffering. We can't imagine that this is suffering. And the only reason is because we haven't looked at our minds. They say, Lama Zopa says, when you've really done the work of going in depth into your mind, which is high school, on the basis of controlling your body and speech through meditation, you see ever more deeply, you know, these disgusting delusions, these nightmarish, painful mental illnesses that are the source of all our suffering, attachment especially. This just takes time. It sounds absurd to us. And why? Because we are living a good life because of virtue in the past. We have a good life. We don't have the grossest suffering, relatively speaking. Good body, reasonable health, some friends, some support, a bit of money in the bank. We can come to a course like this. Leisure, you know, the sun gets up in the morning, it goes down at night, there's no bombs in between. I mean, generally speaking, we can say our lives are like luxurious in comparison with that. But the inner prison, the delusions, and once we start looking, then we're going to start to see. And it's not meant to be depressing. It gives you courage. It gives you compassion for yourself because you realize all these time why you've been suffering is your own nonsense. So look it out there for it. You start looking in here. My friends in prison know this. They know this one. They understand it. They can't change anything else, but they can change their mind. And the one I'm quoting continuously, I remember from years ago, this woman I read about in Florida. I didn't know her. I read her biography. She was this little innocent hippie lady with a hippie husband, 3 hippie kids hitching in Florida. They got picked up by 2 blokes. The blokes got stopped by the coppers, and the 2 blokes killed the coppers and blamed the hippies. So they're on death row in Florida. Can you even imagine? Evil cop killers, the worst killers in the universe in that country. Evil people, evil, treated like animals. The husband even got executed. The children lost. She got out after 17 years because the fellow finally admitted. Can you imagine? The nightmare. You can't conceive of this. But she said, can you only imagine the process she had to go through internally to get to this? She said, I could not change anything, but they couldn't take my mind from me. So I decided I'm not a prisoner. I'm a monk. I'm not in a cell, I'm in a cave. I mean, we love to read these things, but can you only conceive of the pain and the immense inner work? This is the inner prison that she decided to change. I remember reading at the same time one guy who was accused of rape and murder. He went completely insane, screaming every day as long as he had a voice. I did not rape and kill that woman, whatever. He went completely mad. And this is the tragedy of this earth, of human beings, as Lama Zopa says. Most human beings have no idea that what goes on in their mind plays any role at all in their life. So to even be sitting here thinking of the possibility of changing your mind is beyond miraculous, beyond blessed. This is Buddha's deal. Buddha doesn't own this. But he runs with this to a huge, amazing degree, you know. We can change our minds. So, you know, forget being on death row with your husband executed, all unfairly. Can you only conceive of the pain? Can you just look at the little baby things we have? We nearly go mad. Accused wrongly. People don't trust us. Believe us, we did this. Said we did that. Husband leaving us. Children resenting us. I mean, the pain of daily life. This is the inner prison. But because we're so busy with the outer world, we don't notice it. We start going in. A friend of mine went off one time to one of these big retreat centres in France, Nyingma Buddhists. She left New York and went for a year. She went back to New York. She said, Rabina, I had to go back. I just began to see my mind. This is another year and another year. I just began to see my mind, you know. This is amazing for us. The levels to which we can go into our mind to see ever more clearly, ever more crystal clearly, the nonsense, the garbage, the fears, the rubbish, the voices of ego, and distinguish from the amazing virtues, the qualities that are at the core of our being, it's beyond phenomenal, you know. So way to go, this job. But this one of, you know, seeing the delusions is an absolutely necessary job. We don't like to hear about delusions, like your question, you know. We don't like to hear about negativity. We'd rather hear about the good stuff. But, you know, if the weeds are so prevalent, if they're poisoning everything else, you can't ignore them. You've got to know what they are, what the cause is, so you can pull the mothers out. Then you can have the space to grow the flowers, which is what we really are, you know. So we have to have this courage to know our minds, this courage to own what's there. It takes enormous courage, because attachment can't stand seeing it. So, the first step, renunciation. I'm sick of suffering, so I regret everything I've ever done, killing, lying, stealing, not just today, not yesterday, not this life, but since beginningless time. Because you know why? Because I do not want more suffering, please. So if you can't imagine living in a hell realm, which we'll talk tomorrow, you can't imagine being a dog, you can imagine being lied to, stolen from, punched in the nose, raped and murdered, well, think of that. No, yeah, I don't want more of that, please. If karma's true, it's a big leap for us. And you can't even think that. Well, even think this one. Look at the suffering coming from being angry, being depressed, being jealous, right there, just that now. You can say, for sure, I'm sick of this. That is even profound, you know. So I regret whatever I've done because I am sick of suffering. You've got to have this. It's like compassion for yourself. Honestly, it's like that. You've got to own it, taste it, and this is what's so courageous. And this is what, it's like growing up, you know. Then you think, well, whom can I turn to? So now we go for refuge to the Buddha. So what's this? This is the doctor. So like I was saying before, I got lost, I'm going back again. You choose the doctor. You know you like his methods. You've checked him out, you've got confidence, so you rely upon the Buddha. Amazing to have somebody who's got some methods for me. So this is why refuge has zero to do with the relationship I'd have if I were a Catholic, turning to God. I would then have to beg God to forgive me. Buddha, this one, this purification has got zero to do with forgiveness. Of course Buddha would forgive you. He's a nice bloke. But that's not the point. You rely upon the Buddha. He's your mentor, your doctor. You're so happy to have a person whose methods you've got that you want to take, the medicine. That's the relationship with the Buddha. Amazing, you know? Wow. The second part of this second step, reliance, is where you now have compassion for those you've harmed. And they say rely in the sense that you can't have compassion if you don't have people who suffer. Because the objects of compassion are suffering sentient beings. So using the way we talk in the world, the first step's like compassion for yourself. Now you think of those you've harmed. And you have compassion for them. And if you're brave enough, think of those who've harmed you. Have compassion for them. Why? Really clear. Because they will suffer because of what they have done. That's the basis of compassion. Once you have renunciation, one, I'm sick of suffering, but two, I know why I'm suffering, then it's easy to have compassion. Because suffering, compassion is the same. Oh my God, look at that suffering. And now you know why they're suffering. And you know why they're doing it, because of their delusions. So then you can only have compassion. But once you've got renunciation, it's falling off a log easy to have compassion for the pedophiles and the racists and the terrorists. Until you've got renunciation clear, your compassion is not stable. We'll talk about this tomorrow. Now, third step, you take the medicine. You apply the antidote. So you could say in daily life, anything that's the opposite of what you regret is an antidote, clearly. But in this particular tradition, there's one particular practice that is recommended by all the teachers as a really potent medicine in this medicine cabinet of medicines, which is particular, and this is a strong in our tradition, where we any practice we do that we visualize the Buddha, we bring Buddha into the mix. It makes it infinitely more powerful for our minds. And that needs thinking about. Doesn't seem evident on the face of it. So this particular practice is from the Vajrayana. It's the bodhisattva aspect of the Buddha. Okay? So there's Buddha, all right? Buddha. Actual Buddha is unmanifest, all-knowing, all-compassionate consciousness, which, of course, according to the Mahayana, exists forever, never disappears. This is the Mahayana view. Buddha mind is pure, unmanifest consciousness. That's actually Buddha. But, you know, idiots like you and me can't communicate with that. So we have what they call the relative Buddha, which is the form, in this case, Mr. Buddha from 2,500 years ago, the human form he manifests in. So we can see and hear. That's the relative Buddha, the one we need. What was I talking about? Where was I? Okay, thank you. This practice of visualizing the Buddha. Then you've got, in the Mahayana, you've got the Vajrayana teachings, the most sophisticated level. And here this is part of the Bodhisattva path. And so it's the other form in which the Buddha mind manifests is a more subtle form of a light body, which can't be perceived by you and me. It's only perceived by the great bodhisattva meditators in their subtle meditation, where subtle consciousness is now clear. And that's an advanced one. So there's all these visual, all these images you see, not in this room, not many. These paintings, you know, these wonderful looking things, all these ladies and gentlemen with swords and arms and legs and everything. You know, this is all depictions of the different manifestations of the Buddha according to the Mahayana, the bodhisattva aspect. So this particular one is like the Buddha in Tantra. The same as Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, the monk, is the sutra level, or this first level, the wisdom teachings, and then in the bodhisattva teachings, the general Buddha is called Vajrasattva, Vajradhara, okay? Don't go into detail for a moment, we'll just talk about it. It's another aspect of Buddha mind, that's all. And it's particularly used for purification. So one would take refuge in the Buddha in that aspect, you'd visualize above your head. So this third step, you would then do this particular visualization. We're going to do it tomorrow morning, there's no time today. I'll lead you through the practice tomorrow morning. You visualize purifying and you recite a certain mantra. This is big in the Vajrayana, in the Bodhisattva, in the Tibetan practices of the Bodhisattva path. So this reciting of a certain mantra and this visualization, using your mind to imagine purifying. Now the point is, this process of thinking is what changes your mind. Imagining you're purifying is your thoughts. It changes your mind. It changes things. This is how it is, you know. The mind changes the mind by thinking differently. Like the mind deciding to play the right note counteracts the wrong note. So the wrong note's not, you know, the ability to play wrong notes not getting stronger as you play the right note, is it? Every time you play the right note, the tendency to play the wrong one weakens. The same here. Same here. It's a psychological process, you know. The fourth step is, as one lama put it, is the most important, is the 4 R's. It's resolve, the determination not to do again. You make this decision. And this is the point about if you have this, you know, forget God, but in our relationship, let's say I'm yet again badmouth my friend, you know, Fred, in my relationship because I'm angry. And every time, this is the attachment to one, I want to be seen as a good person. Mainly, yes, I'm sorry I did it, but I'm frantic he'll give me up. So I'm desperate to look him in the eyes. Please, Fred, I didn't mean it. I'm so sorry. Please forgive me. Please forgive me. And he says, all right, Rena, I still love you. You feel like you've been let off the hook. But until you say to yourself, I won't do it again, or I won't do it for 5 days, or you make a firm decision, nothing will change. You'll just badmouth him yet again because you've got to make a decision to change yourself. It's not enough to be forgiven by a person. They're just letting you off the hook, that's all. You have got a regret because you're sick of suffering. You have to have compassion. You do the practice and you vow to change. This is this internal process of changing your mind, of purifying. So in the same way, we talked before about how the karma ripens in 4 ways. These 4 steps purify each of these 4 ways specifically as well as all together. So you could say that regretting killing particularly purifies the karma of being killed, the one called experiences similar to the cause. The second one of relying upon sentient beings and having compassion and taking refuge, it seems, purifies the environmental result, which is, you know, sickness and that kind of thing. Third one, doing the main practice, applying the antidote, purifies the lower realm karmic result, which we don't usually think of, you know, this is Buddha's view. And the fourth one, the most obvious, if you vow never to kill again, if you reiterate your vow every day, what do you think you're doing? It's not just wishful thinking. You're digging that groove in your mind ever more deeply, ever more deeply, ever more deeply. You're training yourself to play the right note. You're training yourself to never want to kill. So tomorrow, guess what? You won't kill. Hardly rocket science. So that purifies the habit to kill. So this is how karma ripens. We'll have to talk more tomorrow. But I'm giving these 2 examples, you know. I said before, I think, let's say in our case, we have got a human body, which is a fruit of virtuous karma. But because we haven't purified all aspects of karma, this is a tragedy. We have the residual results, let's say, of just killing. Forget the others. In this life. So there's these 2 examples I give, these 2 kids, sons of friends of mine. One, little boy, you know, lots of good karma, good experiences similar to the cause, good tendencies, good environmental karma, human birth, but he had a tendency to kill. He saw fishing from the age of 5. It's like he fell in love with it and he spent the rest of his life fishing. He died, and then he died scuba diving, fishing. He like even called himself Salmon. Sal for short. He so fantasized fishing, which is what attachment does. Attachment make look, for his case, not cake or not Fred, but fishing, looked divine to him because he had this powerful, we can deduce that he had this powerful tendency to kill. So the tragedy is this. He's a little boy, bopping along with his mummy in California, good rebirth, good this, good that, lovely human being, kind, generous, intelligent, she said, but he suddenly sees fishing for the first time. It triggers the karmic tendency. But it was latent until then. And then it instantaneously triggers attachment, which makes the fishing look divine. And tragically, attachment triggers a really nice feeling in his body and mind. So logically, because we're junkies for good feelings, we will deduce that whatever triggered the good feeling, Fred, the cake, the fishing, the torturing, the raping, you name it, which is a tendency in your mind you brought with you because you didn't purify, because he never vowed not to kill. He'd been in the lower realms for the Buddha. That karma ran out, but he didn't make a decision, I'll never kill again. He comes into this life tragically with the tendency to keep killing. So off he goes and he kills. He spends the rest of his life killing. And the tragedy is he never saw the suffering. His mother went fishing with him 1 time. She found it unbearable, she said. Because why? Because she didn't have attachment to killing, therefore she didn't have the karmic imprint, therefore she wasn't blinded, so she could see nakedly that these fish were not happy. All they wanted to be was in the water, please. But this very intelligent, kind boy, because of being blinded by his own attachment and his own habit and the good feelings, that he literally couldn't see reality. Literally, literally couldn't ever see suffering. This is a tragedy. So we can deduce that he did finish the karma of being in the lower realms, but he didn't make the decision never to kill again. So tragically born in a human life, and I have to swear here, I'm sorry, no, I won't swear. He tips his life down the toilet. So he dies scuba diving. 29 years old. There's more to it than that. I'll tell you tomorrow. So then the other one, the other story is at 6 o'clock. The other one is this other example of a friend of mine, a little boy, 3 years old. And she's taking the lice out of his head, and he's crying with compassion for the lice. Mommy, mommy, leave them alone. Don't hurt them. It's their home. He's trying to do everything to stop her hurting the lice. Both of those mothers had not taught their children. This is karmic imprints. This is why we should, our hearts should break for harmers. You're just following your junkie of thoughts, you know. And this is the worst suffering. We'll go into more detail. The fisherman, it triggered pleasure in him. So we don't mind fishing because fishing is normal for us, but we don't think of it as torture. It's torture. If he was addicted to killing poodles, he'd be in serious trouble. We'd all want to hang him up, you know, to dry, wouldn't we? Because we're attached to poodles. All the things we have, all the torturers, the pedophiles, it's habits, it's terrible, terrible addictions coming into this life. Once you understand your own mind in this way, then you can afford to have compassion for the harmless. Okay, not sentimental compassion. Put them in jail. Protect them from themselves and others. No question. This fisherman spent his life fishing, never saw suffering. That's the tragedy. This little boy, other one, we can deduce he must have vowed in the past by doing practices like this to never kill again, because he wakes up in this life with zero imprint to kill and with compassion. So he's now 40-something. He's never killed a living being. This is the power of vows, and this is the power of making decisions every day, programming your mind, playing the right notes until it's habitual. This is why Lama Zopa says, we are insane not to do these four steps every day. You finish your day with it. And as Lama Zopa said, Lama Yeshe said, then you go to sleep with a happy mind. So abiding by the laws of karma, living in vows of karma, even more potent, and purifying every day, you have a perfect practice. And I'm not even suggesting you start to meditate yet. Please don't underestimate this. You go to high school, then you start to meditate because you've calmed your body, speech, and beginning to speech, control your mind. Now you can go deep into your mind through meditation and start uprooting the nonsense, which is the source of why we do bad things. And at this level, this is how you get rid of the second kind of suffering. We'll talk more tomorrow, you know. Regret? No, regret, which is got renunciation in it. It's on the basis of renunciation that you regret harming because you're sick of suffering. The second one is reliance. Two parts. You rely upon the Buddha, you take refuge, but you also, the way that Tibetans talk, you rely on sentient beings, meaning you need suffering sentient beings in order to have compassion, don't you? So they call that reliance. So the first part is refuge, the second part is compassion for others. The third is the remedy. The fourth is resolve, determination to change. So if you've got vows, you'd reiterate your vows every day. But if you haven't, you know, if you're not quite sure you're not going to stop killing yet, you don't say you'll never kill again. You take yourself at your own pace. You say, maybe I'll give it a go, just stop killing for 24 hours. You don't lie to yourself. You're being very realistic here. This is why this has got nothing to do with guilt. You've got to engage in this process, and you're talking to yourself. It's got nothing to do with Buddha or your therapist. It's you being your own therapist, being your own friend. You rely upon Buddha, but you're the one doing the work. You're the boss here, you know. And it's a very powerful way to end the day. You kind of lift the burdens, you know. Because we're all so neurotic and miserable. No wonder we're exhausted by the end of the day with all our dramas, you know. You go to bed with them and come up the next day, lugging around this rubbish. This practice is so helpful because you clean up your act, you know. You kind of, it's you and it's you doing it. So profound. You're making decisions. You're being in charge. Are we communicating? It's in your book anyway. You can read it if you like tonight. So good night. We're leaving now. We'll finish. So we'll sing a little prayer. Maybe we can join in. Can you show me your book and I'll check? I haven't got my iPad with me. Yeah, the last page. There's some dedication prayers we can read together. These are five little kind of aspirations that Lama Zopa says sort of summarize all the best thoughts for us. Remembering every thought counts. Every thought sows a seed. So these five, oh, plus this, actually one, two, three, four, there's six actually. Okay, just read together if you'd like, or just listen, make them your thoughts if you like. As a result of the three times merits of myself and others, may bodhicitta, from which the happiness of all sentient beings comes, be generated in the minds of self and other sentient beings without delay, even for 1 second, and that which has been generated, may it increase. As a result of the three times merits of myself and others, may emptiness be generated in the minds of self and other sentient beings without delay, even for 1 second, and that which has been generated, may it increase. As a result of the three times merits of myself and others, may... Oh, hang on a minute. We've got two prayers here for emptiness. Never mind, I made a mistake. We can do this one, not the last one. That's fine. As a result of the three times merits of myself and others, may I, who am empty from my own side, achieve Guru Shakyamuni Buddha's enlightenment, which is empty from its own side, and lead all sentient beings who are empty from their own side to that enlightenment which is empty from its own side as quickly as possible by myself alone. Whatever dedication one's gone to bliss, of the three times have admired as best, I shall also perfectly dedicate in the same way all these roots of virtue so that I may perform good works. Because of the past, present and future merit created by me and by the Buddhas, Bodhisattvas and sentient beings, may I, my family, students and all sentient beings be able to actualize completely in this very lifetime Lama Tsongkhapa's path of unified sutra and tantra, which is pure like refined gold, and may this pure teaching of Lama Tsongkhapa spread in all directions and flourish forever. The next one's a variation of the earlier one, so that's it. So thank you, everybody. Good night. And so listen, a bit of homework. Even if you don't come back, I'll give you some homework. So you've got two bits to your homework. One is to, when you go to sleep, before you go to sleep, you make a decision to see your dreams as dreams. Because, you know, the Lamas use this wonderful analogy, a way of understanding emptiness. One of them is you see life as an illusion, or you see life as a dream, and there's real meaning to that. We'll talk about emptiness tomorrow, okay? So it's really nice to... Because the whole point is, for Buddha, we're completely out of control. We just kind of drag from pillar to post like a puppet, aren't we? No control. So even to be able to have control in your dreams and to be aware that you're dreaming is very tasty. It's developing some power of awareness, you know? So it's very nice to do that. Not so much remember your dreams, it's more that when you're dreaming, you notice you're dreaming. So see if you can do it. When you go to sleep, I will see my dreams as dreams. See what happens. The second one, and you're supposed to laugh now, if you wake up in the morning, right? You get my point, because we will all believe we wake up in the morning, won't we? We'll believe it totally. Why? Because we believe in permanent me. A big fat delusion, big lie. You do market research tomorrow morning and in a 50-mile radius, you knock on doors, I will guarantee you'll find many people, many houses where somebody died tonight who didn't expect to die, like us, who thought, like us, that we're permanent. It's really, we never do surveys like that, do we? You know, who died today? Uh-huh, proving impermanence. We don't do that. But we know it's true. So go to bed and think, if I wake up in the morning, how amazing, my karmic petrol tank hasn't run out yet, and that really is the way they'd say in Buddhism. You wake up in the morning, you bliss out. I can't believe it. My petrol tank hasn't run out. I'm still alive. May I make the most of today. Come to the teachings, do this, do that, so I can develop my qualities, so I can be a benefit to others. Which is helping us get a sense of impermanence, because it's a fact. Impermanence is a fact, you know. We have to try and be in sync with it, which is the Buddha's deal, right? Okay. Thank you. Good night.